actually, I don't think it's really necessary to give a sort of a rehash of what we have heard in times past concerning husband-wife relationships and what husbands are expected to do under these given circumstances and what they're not expected to do and all that. Most of you are already aware of that material from times past, and I'm sure that there would be any number of published articles in the past that would cover that. So I think for the sake of repetition, I will not go into that particular phase of it today, but I thought rather than to cover it from that vantage point, I would look at three major areas that I feel the church was affected by with respect to what happened from 1972 on, and these particular areas could be improved upon by the husbands. It would certainly make them better Christian husbands. Now, I think we would all agree, I think we've seen this demonstrated historically. We certainly have seen it demonstrated in actual practicality in respect to what happened within the church from the improper approach that was taken in administration. And that is that there was really no facet of one's life, or there was not a single overlooked facet in the whole Christian experience and living that we all endeavored to follow in times past that was not properly administered. And when I say improperly administered, I mean that what I'm going to point out here is the beginning point. The principle was absolutely correct and right and true. But how it was applied by the husbands in the family relationship with their wives was a result of being misguided by an improper administrative system. And the number one point I'm going to give first of all here is, I think it is a necessity for us to have a better understanding and a balanced understanding and a proper understanding of what the Bible really means when it says a husband is to be the head of the house. I call this the husband head syndrome. Now, first of all, let me say that I am not saying, nor am I teaching, nor do I believe that the church was wrong in the past in its basic understanding of what the Bible says about the husband. In fact, we can notice some scriptures here which very candidly will make the Bible teaching very plain on it. For example, we know that God created Adam first. The Bible says so. Between the time that Adam was created and Eve was created, Adam had the opportunity to witness all the other creatures that God had created. And it says specifically there was found no help meet or no mate for him. And so God then made Eve. Now, I'm quite sure that God had that in mind from the very beginning. It wasn't that he decided, you know, he went at it haphazardly and he didn't quite know what he was doing. Then all of a sudden it dawned on him, you know, that he'd better make a help meet for Adam. I'm sure that he had that in mind from the very beginning. But one thing he did do in allowing Adam to witness his other creation and then to bring in Eve, he then created within Adam a great sense of appreciation for what God had made for him. But the man was made first. And so we read here in Genesis 2, verse number 23, Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Or she was taken out of man. So she was actually created from Adam. So in that sense, they really were one flesh. Now, that entire picture was to be extended right on down in the entire marriage relationship thereafter, because that's why it says here, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." So they were united in one, but the husband was given the preeminence, being the first created, and Eve was taken from him. Now, a little bit later on, when we find out that Eve was the one that succumbed to the temptation, Adam, I guess, in trying to please her, went along with it, even though he himself, apparently, from the account, there was no confrontation between Adam and the devil. The confrontation was between Eve and the devil. She, in turn, was deceived, and then she just simply came and gave it to Adam, and he went along with her. So there's no deception on his part. But that's why you read here, after this deception had occurred and the sin had taken place, then God said unto the woman, he said, this is Genesis 3, verse 16, "I will greatly multiply thy labor." Some translations show the word labor to be far more accurate here. "In thy pregnancy, in labor shall you bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." God then placed within womankind a programmed makeup where it is natural and the proper thing for her to be submissive to her husband and to be subservient to him. I know that in a lot of circles today, that's a very unpopular thing to say, particularly with the advent of this women's liberation movement, which one astute author has very candidly recognized as a form of rebellion, first of all, against God, and secondly, against the fact of being human, and thirdly, against the fact of even being female. And the entire movement itself is a form, it's a form of rebellion and a dissatisfaction of even being a human. But you know, if you're born here as a flesh and blood human being, whether you're male or female, you might as well face the fact you're here, and you might as well learn to make the best out of it. And the way that you can make the best out of it is to fall within the framework that God intended and that God created. And he says here very plainly that in a normal relationship, the way it ought to be and the way it was intended, the wife has a desire to be subservient to her husband. Now, we all know it's a very sad home where the rooster is silent and the hen crows. But it just so happens to be there's a lot of homes like that today because people do not know the proper standards. Their world is topsy-turvy. They have come from backgrounds that are certainly non-biblical, and they've been perverted in a lot of their thinking, which we'll see a little bit later on. And so, you know, as the Bible says, everything is out of course. But in fact, nevertheless remains, God created the man first and the woman. In the natural scheme of things and the way God intended, the woman was to be subservient to the husband and the husband was to be the head. Now that is not only an Old Testament teaching, that is also a New Testament teaching. Because the Apostle Paul tells us here in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse number 3, "But I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man." That's the order. I didn't create it. I didn't invent it. I did not put it in the Bible. It's been there from the very beginning, and that's the way God intends it. So I want to establish here at the very beginning, then, the church was certainly correct in its teaching in times past when it emphasized and demonstrated and showed the proper order of authority and responsibility in the home as given by God. I'll get to a moment here to demonstrate that how that was applied was another matter. But let's notice here now, going to 1 Timothy, the second chapter, another statement which is made by the Apostle Paul again and again represents New Testament teaching. And this is what he says. He's giving instruction here on how women ought to adorn themselves. And then he skips down, I'm going to skip down here to verse number 11, and here's what he says. "Let the woman learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not a woman to teach or to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence." Why? "For Adam was first formed, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, was in the transgression." So the way God views it, from a matter of accountability, he held the woman responsible for allowing this deception to set in, even though Adam, as a rightful head, should have assumed his responsibility and corrected the situation. But in all probability, he was too inexperienced at the time to know how to handle it. You know, it's very easy for us to sit back and say, well, now if I'd been there, I wouldn't have done it. You don't know what you would have done. You know, most people who get into jams or get into accidents or get into various escapades of one type or another, who develop problems of one sort or another, generally those things happen because of a lack of experience. And the old statement is certainly true. Experience is what you have left when everything else is gone. But nevertheless, let us notice how God viewed it here. Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, was in the transgression. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. I'm not going to go into that particular text to try to explain it because there are at least three or four different explanations for it. But it does show that God places his hand of blessing upon the woman if she is a Christian woman and understands the proper order of authority and responsibility that God has placed within the human race. Now, there's one other text that should be read here with respect to this particular subject, and then I want to comment on what happened in the past. First of all, 1 Corinthians 14, and the reason I'm commenting on this is this. If we want a proper understanding and a proper balance of what the proper relationship should be, with the husband being the head of the household and the woman being subservient to it, we might as well be honest with ourselves and admit that this was not properly approached in the past. Now, the other danger is simply this, that if you grew up in the church, and I can think of people now that are up in their 30s, middle 30s and even 40s, that are second generation Christians who grew up in the church. And if you grew up in the church, to a certain degree, this is rubbed off on you. And even though you may not be aware of it openly, subconsciously, you have been affected by this attitude and this spirit. If there's any way you can avoid it. This is why often when you see, and I've seen this happen repeatedly, so I know what I'm talking about. Going back in marriages, you know, people get married, and we used to stand up in our marriage ceremony, and we'd say, there can be no happier occasion than this we now enter. And then a minister starts a marriage ceremony. And I wonder very much whether or not whenever I performed a marriage ceremony, all I'm doing is generating a lot of misery for a couple of people. Because that happens all too often. Because they have all kinds of problems that have to be worked out. And you know, you find out in short order that to make a marriage happy and successful requires work. Requires effort, it requires sacrifice. And you know, you ought to hear the real story about Cinderella. You've all heard the story about Cinderella. Well, read the Peter prescription and you'll find out the real story of what happened to Cinderella. And it's not like the fairy tale you've been told. Because people have an idea in mind what they think something is going to be like, but experiencing it is another matter. But you see, what happens is that when you've had that kind of an environment and atmosphere for many, many years, and you've grown up within the church, and you've been associated with it for a long time, even in a subconscious matter, some of these principles have rubbed off to the extent that you are likely, I've seen this happen repeatedly in couples that I've performed marriages for and others within the church, where the youngster gets married and he will take that same almost tyrannical, misapplied, Gnostic approach in dealing with his wife that the church had in practically every single thing it attempted to administer. Now, it wasn't because people were trying to make other people miserable. It wasn't because the church was trying to make you unhappy. It was not because the church was trying to see how it could deprive you of the benefits of life. There was one reason and one reason only the church did what it did in times past and the way it falsely administered things, and that is, it thought it labored under the mistaken notion that if it were the true church, everybody in it had to be perfect, and it was therefore the church's duty to make everybody perfect. But you cannot take imperfect men and make perfect church members. And this forced kind of perfection only led to what after 1972? It really demonstrated how many people were really devoted to God and His truth, as opposed to those who were really dedicated to a church organization out of fear tactics, of prophecy hype, or whatever was involved, because the vast majority of these people did not respond to God's truth, and they were not really trying to live up to their Christian calling because of a relationship with God. The same thing applied to many marriages. I may be getting ahead of the story to make this comment, but I think I can safely say that the entire syndrome of the male masculinity, head of the household, let's say, configuration that all of the church families found themselves in, led to later on a great deal of resentment and bitterness. And when the church threw out the proper teaching it had once understood about marriage and divorce, then what happened within the church? Divorce and bitterness and anguish became rampant. So were people really devoted to one another? Did they really love one another? And did they love God's truth? Or were they living in a marriage configuration based on fear of a church organization? I think you know the answer to that. Now, as we get over here to 1 Corinthians 14, verse number 34, and this is the reason I say that you'll often find second generation Christians, they may not even be aware of it. But that has been deeply ingrained into their thinking and their minds, and they will have the tendency to repeat exactly what was done wrong by the church for many years. Now, of course, when they kicked off the traces, or they kicked over the traces in 1972, 73, 74, then everybody went to the opposite extreme. But the Bible teaching is quite implicit here and plain, because it says here, for example, 1 Corinthians 14, verse number 34, "Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak. But they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for a woman to speak in the church." Now, I was reading some little brochure or little pamphlet written by some religious group that is very left-leaning. And this author was going through these various texts trying to demonstrate that this did not mean that women should not preach in the church. Well, we needn't get into that in this particular subject here, because we're not talking about women preachers. We're talking about a line of authority that God gave originally. And of that line of authority, he says here that they are not permitted to speak. And obviously it must mean in some type of a public atmosphere. And if they will learn anything, let them learn at home, because it's even regarded as a shame for them to be in some kind of a public officialdom here. Certainly the implication is within the church. So it does demonstrate very plainly that from the vantage point of the Bible and the teaching that God originally gave, there was a line of authority to the husband and to the wife. But what happened in the past, and many of you old-time members will remember this, because beginning somewhere in the early 50s, maybe by the mid-50s, if any of you are around that long, you will remember how the whole thrust began to develop about the husband being the head of the household and the male dominant leader in the home, and the wife was to respect her place. And there was sermon after sermon after that to sort of browbeat women into their proper position in life. Do any of you remember that? I say this, at any time you have to browbeat somebody into submission, it really isn't submission in the first place, not from a biblical viewpoint. Because all you had in the end, you had all these wonderful, happy marriages in the church. I can remember how it was braggingly said that in all these years, we've never had a divorce from a couple from Ambassador College. That might be true, but I can tell you this. I bet there are a lot of miserable couples living together, all putting on a nice facade of propriety. And then what happened after 1974, when the doctrinal change on divorce and remarriage was made? Did you find these couples really cemented together in love and in one, in a proper union with God? Or were they there only because, and had they been there, only because the church said they were supposed to be there, and they had no real love and desire to obey God, and they didn't even cultivate any love for one another? And I can remember very well, some of you can too, that couples were literally pressured into marriage. And the local minister had the authority of sort of picking out who was suited for whom, and God help you if you went against it. It's almost as bad as these Moonies, you know, where they'll have 1,000 couples all getting married at the same time in one big ceremony. Of course, they'll all be interracially mixed. That wasn't the case then, as far as the true church was concerned. I'm not so sure what may be the case now. But the point of the matter is that young men were sort of forced, you know, and just cajoled and just wheedled and agitated and picked on and humiliated and everything else until they finally made that step and got married, because the church told them they ought to be married. A lot of cases they married a person they should never have married, because of differences in backgrounds, differences in personalities. You know, it's just like I tell my children all the time, you know, I tell them, you better do some serious thinking about ever getting married, because I'll tell you this, it's tough enough to really get along and to have a happy marriage when you're both converted and believe exactly alike spiritually. Now, how'd you like to come home and have this husband? He wants his pork, and he wants to sit down all Sabbath and watch the latest TV, and he doesn't give a hoot about tithing. He's going to spend his money here. He's going to go gambling. He's going to do this and do that. How'd you like to be married under those circumstances? So you see, the truth of the matter is that what held all the marriages together in the church in one great big happy family was church authority. Fear of going contrary to the church. Not because these people had cultivated a love for one another, not because a husband really understood his responsibility with God and viewed his wife as his partner and as his companion. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But because somehow or other he was told by the church he was the head of the household and he was going to exercise that. And I mean, you talk about draconian methods that were put to practice on the behalf of many, many husbands. There was no consideration in many cases shown for their wives. It was a teaching. It was an insidious teaching that had been absorbed by many, many men. And it was a wrong teaching. So I'm just simply pointing out, if we're going to make improvements, remember how I entitled this originally, How to Be a Better Christian Husband. What I'm saying is that while it is true, absolutely certain and true, that God made the man to be the head of the household and there's a delineation of authority granted by God, he had better come to understand what the proper balance of handling that is. And any time he has to force his wife into submission, he always has to be browbeating her because he's saying, I'm the head of this house and I'll do such and such and you'll do this. And he doesn't take her thoughts and her needs into consideration. Is he really the head of the house from God's viewpoint? Is he handling it properly? Not at all. Not at all. Okay, that's the first thing. So let me say point number one. A major area improvement we can all learn by, and that includes those of us who are older, and that includes second generation Christians, and that is we need to recognize that while the principles behind the husband being the head of the house were the true principles, the way that it was administered in the past was wrong. And it led to many, many problems. Among them, chief among them, the fact that these couples didn't really develop a love and a desire and a teamwork for one another. And as soon as the doorways were open for divorce, they started glancing eyes here and there at somebody else. So that today, if you'd walk into a church, you're liable to find half the people you know with somebody else's husband or wife. Okay, now the second point. One of the saddest experiences that I ever had, I've preached, I guess, altogether close to 70 funerals. And there were only two funerals that I came close to breaking down and crying in. One of them was a woman who had a little child that was about 18 months old and it was retarded and it died, just suddenly died. And a week later, she had another baby and it was a stillborn baby. And I had to perform both of those funerals about a week apart in cold, wintry, snow weather in Missouri. And I'll tell you that, I almost broke down on that second one. And the husband was gone. He was off on a long truck driving haul, and he wasn't there for any one of those two deaths or those two funerals. It was tragic. That was just one. The other one relates to the subject that I'm covering today, and this involved a 25-year-old young woman from back east who was dying of lung cancer. Her parents were church members, and I believe she had been too, or was a church member, and she had come from further back east home to stay there to spend her remaining few weeks in dying. And her husband was so torn up by her suffering and her agony that he wouldn't even go near her, and he let her stay home and die by herself at home. I went down to see her, to talk with her, and she was in her room, and she was just nothing but skin and bone. She'd have been a beautiful blonde woman. And she was just nothing but skin and bone, and she was just gasping for every breath of air as she was explaining to me what happened. And she was telling me about her husband, how he treated her. Now, he wasn't a church member. I don't believe that a single thing that she told me that he did deliberately. I think he probably lacked understanding. Maybe a lot of it was due to his own background and environment and upbringing. I don't think it was done deliberately. I think it was probably done ignorantly. He may have even been well-meaning in what happened. But see, he worked and she worked. And he had some kind of a chauvinistic idea in his mind that it was his duty to provide for the family, but he couldn't do one single thing to help her around that home. And so she'd come from an 8-hour work at her job, and then she would have to come in and take care of the little kids, go get the kids to the babysitter, take care of the kids, prepare the meal, clean the house, do the dishes, and do all the housework on top of her job, and be up in the morning and have to take care of all the whole house and feed him. And he didn't even offer to pick up those little children and help carry them out to the car to take them to the babysitter or even carry her bags. And she felt in her own mind that she was so exhausted and just worn out from having to do two jobs. And somehow in his mind, he didn't feel he should lift his finger to do one little thing. I think to her dying day, she probably felt that partially or maybe wholly contributed to her cancer. Maybe it did. In other words, what I'm saying is that the point number two that I'm emphasizing here in areas of improvement are that we have got to recognize that if we're in a marriage relationship, we are heirs together, both spiritually and physically. That means not only do we work together as a team spiritually, but we may be required to work together physically. I can remember there was a time in my own marriage when I had similar concepts. It was a part of the training and the teaching. And the man was not to do anything that was the woman's job, and the woman's job was to take care of the home and the family. Well, sure. Ideally, that's the case. But what happens if we're living in a socialistic society the way we're living today, where the wife is also forced to work? Then is the whole responsibility hers, or does the husband have some in sharing in the home too? Now, you know, I'm saying here that we're to be heirs together, physically and spiritually. Actually, the Bible teaching is very candid and plain on the matter of divorce and remarriage. And a lot of modern couples now, you know, they don't really believe the Bible. They don't even know what it says in most cases. And as soon as things are rowing, gets to be a little tough, one of them's ready to jump ship. Doesn't take very long. In fact, in many cases, it takes hardly anything. First financial crisis that comes up, you know, the first sickness that comes up, the first problem that comes up, one of them's ready to bolt. But Jesus said, "It has been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say to you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery." Now I asked one of these supposedly renowned scholars on the doctrinal committee down there in 1975, if he would explain this text to me, you know, because I didn't feel that there was any legitimate excuse the church could generate in its own perverse thinking at that time to come up with what Jesus' plain statement was. And so when I asked this so-called scholar this, you know what his answer was? He said, "That text is too vague for anybody to understand." Well, I can tell you this. All you had to do is look at all the couples that were just waiting for the day when they could get rid of each other because they had never really cultivated an heir-together concept. The thing was completely one-sided and, in most cases, heavy-handed on the part of the husband. Now, one of the things that God says, you know, what is your wife called? You know, I went back to Montana this summer. I had a very pleasant surprise. Lo and behold, who met me but my old high school buddy. I can tell you, of all human beings that I've ever known, he and I were the two closest. He was the closest friend I ever had. He was right down there to meet me, took me where I needed to go. But I can tell you, there was a time when the two of us, it wouldn't have made any difference. What was required, we would have done it for one another. I mean, you talk about a friendship and a companionship there, we're just inseparable. All right, is that what your wife is supposed to be to you? The Bible calls her your companion. All of you probably had a close friend like that. How did you treat them? Do you treat your wife the same way you treated your close friend? A lot of husbands don't. They treat their wife just like some chattel piece of property or something like that, somebody they can order around, but she's not really a companion to them. Now maybe it's partially the wife's fault. I'm not pointing any fingers one direction. I'm just asking you to analyze the relationship you have with your mate. What is your relationship? Is it one of friendship? Is it one of companionship? Well, you know, you go back here to the book of Malachi, you know, these people are crying because they can't have everything they want, and they're wondering why all the blessings aren't befalling them and why things aren't going right for them, and God tells them why. God says, "Because the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you have dealt treacherously." It was Malachi 2, verse 14. In this case, they put away their wives. They got tired of them, you know. They had a wife, you know, and they got up to be middle-aged, and they started looking around at some young thing that had a pretty figure, you know, and rolling eyes, and so they'd kick out the wife and they'd take up with some young woman. How many people have done that today? God said it's treacherous to do that kind of thing. And then what does he say about the wife? Yet, is she your companion and the wife of your covenant? Is your wife your companion and is your wife your friend? One lady told my wife one time, she was talking about her ex-husband, she said, well, he was my lover, but he wasn't my friend. You know, if there's anybody that ought to be your friend, it ought to be your wife. And vice versa. You see, I'm saying here, if we're heirs together, we're heirs together spiritually and physically. And I can tell you this, by far, the most important thing that will really make a marriage successful if the two of you can sit down and then you can talk and converse and you have a meeting of minds. That's the number one thing. Everything else is really secondary and subservient to that. You could have everything else going, but if there's no meeting of minds and you cannot sit down and communicate and you can't talk with one another, what do you have? So you see, I'm saying we have to learn to be heirs together, both physically and spiritually. Now you go over here to 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter. And in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, this is how Paul explains it. He's talking of a more specific topic in a particular context here, but I'll broaden it for the purpose of this sermon here and say it in this manner. You see, this is 1 Corinthians 7, verse number 3. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. In other words, due consideration, due kindness, due tenderness. You know, looking out for her interests. It's due her. This is what he's supposed to do. And how many husbands do you find today who have very little consideration for their wives? Their first consideration is for themselves. And they would never think one single time of ever sacrificing what they want to do and what's pleasant for them in order to make the wife happy, to do something for her. It never dawns on their minds ever to do that. Now, sometime that may be required, you know, but the question is, when it gets right down to the real nitty-gritty, what decision are you going to make when it comes to that? Ephesians 5, verse number 25, Paul says, husband, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. As we'll see when we get to the matter here of the wives, the one thing they're told repeatedly in the Bible to do is to submit, which evidently is a difficult thing for most women to do, particularly if they're married to some kind of an overlord, you know, that doesn't use the proper finesse and poise and everything that's necessary for her to automatically want to respect and obey him and be submissive. The thing it says repeatedly to the man is love your wife. Why? Because that's the most difficult thing for him to do. You know why? Because he loves himself far more than he loves his wife most of the time. And you'd be amazed. I suppose if a person could ever really take a survey of families and husbands and wives in general to find out and ask the wives how many wives really feel their husbands love them based on what they do, I think we'd probably be shocked at the replies. You see, a man gets his ego patted or massaged, I guess you could say, by his success in his job, by the notoriety that he receives and what he accomplishes in life, by his financial success or so forth. But women don't get, you know, if they're a wife and a mother, they're not going to get their recognition that way. The only way they're going to get it is from their husband. Most husbands take their wives for granted. I mean, it is just incredible. I think it's good every once in a while, you know, and I have to admit this to myself, even though I don't like it. If my wife gets sick or something, comes down with something, then it's really good for me to experience having to eat my daughter's cooking and a few other things like that, because really, not that it's that bad, but it really makes me appreciate my wife. Anyway, over here in the book of Colossians, the 3rd chapter and verse number 19, notice what he says. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. You know, most husbands will admit that their wives and their children will make them 10 times madder than anybody else will. I guess it's because they expect more of them, and when they don't see it, it makes them far more upset because they don't expect that from the public or from some outsider, some neighbor, something like that. But if their wife flubs a dub or the children flub the dub, they'll get angrier faster and longer with that than any other thing. And that's probably the reason Paul says, be not bitter against them. Because sometimes a husband, he'll just get it in for his wife and he'll just hold a grudge and he'll just be upset for days on end. So, you know, there's a reason the Bible always admonishes men to love their wives, because it's not an easy thing to do. And yet the truth of the matter is, even though the man was made the head of the household, the wife was made for the man, they are still one the way God views it, and one doesn't have precedence above the other, because as Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 11, that is in the spiritual sense, there is no precedence really. Because as he says here in 1 Corinthians 11, verse number 11, nevertheless, neither is the man without the woman, neither the woman without the man in the Lord. So really, one doesn't have precedence over the other in a spiritual relationship, he's saying here. In fact, if you just view it strictly from the pure physical aspect of it, the average female has just a little over one half of the strength of the average man. In other words, if you could just use a round figure, he has twice as much physical strength as she does. But academically, from the academic viewpoint, they're even, or the women are even slightly ahead in many, many areas. And the only one area academically that men tend to have superiority over is in abstract thinking. So God did not make the woman to be some kind of a subservient piece of chattel, inferior and wholly undeserving of any of the merits and credits that should be given rightfully to her. Trouble is, so many people just tend to be very thoughtless and they are not prone to appreciate the good things that God has given them, namely their wives. But, you know, she is called a weaker vessel, as we see over here in 1 Peter, the 3rd chapter, in verse number 13. 1 Peter 3 and verse number 7. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge. And actually, the Greek word for knowledge here means wise consideration. Dwell with them according to wise consideration. That means have consideration. Now, use wisdom in it, you know. Sometimes you can be considered to the point of a lack of wisdom, too, you know. Wise consideration. Sometimes it is necessary to put the foot down. That ought to be the exception rather than the rule. And if you are what God intends you to be, and you're the head of your household, and you can demonstrate it by your judgment, by your good sense, by your masculinity, by your ability to make wise decisions and this type of thing, just by your mere physical presence, a wife is automatically going to look up and respect that. You're not going to have to be browbeating her all the time. Dwell with them according to wise consideration, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel. That means treat her tenderly. Instead of being angry, try a little tenderness. You're liable to get far better results that way. Giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life. So what are we? I'm saying, in order to improve the husband's responsibility, how to be a better Christian husband, he should recognize the necessity of being an heir together with his wife, both physically and spiritually. Now, if we're living in a modern-day society, which we're living in today, which is increasingly socialistic, and as I'll get to it here in a few minutes, the aim and goal of certain people in very, very powerful positions in this world is to destroy and eradicate the state of marriage, and to do it economically is one of the most effective ways of doing it, so that probably 50 to 60% of the women today are in the workforce, forced out of the home, and they cannot really be in the home to take care of the children in the home and the family properly, and the husband and wife both work, then I say this, he'd better face up his responsibility of chipping in and helping out in that home and helping her with those duties.
Sure, that's not the ideal situation. We're not living in an ideal world, are we? So we better make the best of it. And I say that any husband that won't do that is really not deserving to be a husband. Unless he's so well healed and he's so well paid and he's got such a good job that she can stay at home and devote her energies and time to the home and she doesn't have to be out working, then he better face his inadequacy, even though it may be no fault of his own. Some character sitting up on Wall Street can take a stroke of his pen and change his job, and change his ability to make money overnight. So maybe it is something beyond his control. But if it is, he'd better still acknowledge the fact that the ideal situation calls for him working and him supporting his wife, and if he can't, then he better be helping out in the home. And he shouldn't feel ashamed to do it either. Okay, she is called a weaker vessel. This woman that I performed this funeral for over there back east, she didn't want any church hymns sung at her funeral service, and rather she chose three of her most favorite songs. They weren't anything that was bad. They were, you know, old favorites that most of you heard, and she played those at her funeral. And her husband, he just came to view her dead body and to bury her, and that's all he saw. They had a little child. He took the child back with him when he went back east. But as she was talking to me and just gasping for breath and tears rolling down her eyes, she was telling me how he didn't even have enough consideration that when she was so weak, already just weak and was just exhausted and tired all the time from her job and having come home and do all the homework and everything, and then he would have her pick up the little kids and all the bags and everything and carry them out to the car. I'll never forget her describing that to me. I'm not saying he did it deliberately. You know, most of us do things ignorantly, don't we? We do it from a lack of experience. We do it from a lack of understanding. We do it from a lack of knowledge. But for whatever reason, we do tend to do these things. All right, we can profit by our mistakes, and hopefully we can profit by the mistakes of others. But let's realize it is the Bible's intention that we be heirs together physically and spiritually. All right, the third and the final point then that we're going to emphasize for husbands, how to be a better Christian husband, is a necessity to build up and support the weaker vessel. I'm talking in this case not just physically, I'm talking about spiritually, I'm talking about emotionally, you know, I'm talking about the various aspects. Sure, it would certainly include making a living physically, but it means that in the general sense, the wife is the weaker vessel and does need that support. You know, one of the most insidious campaigns of the modern times in which we're living in today has been a deliberate campaign financed by people with evil intentions to do away with the state of marriage. And they want to do away with the home. They want to do away with the family. They'd rather everybody live like animals in a big communal type of a situation. And so how is the wife depicted? She's depicted as some kind of a dumb dodo, and she's missing out on all the real things of life. And the real joys and the real accomplishments of life can only be realized as she goes out and becomes a career woman. And because of that propaganda that bombards the public and the airwaves and the newspapers and the publications day and night, 24 hours a day, many women have succumbed to the notion that being in the home is not really an honorable thing and it isn't the best place to be, and she'd get more out of life if she could go out and make herself famous in some kind of a career. How many women have fallen for that kind of propaganda? All too many. Now, can the husband help her? In the home, if your wife is there in the home, how honorable is the home and the children and the family in the sight of God? Boy, I can tell you this, it's a lot more honorable than a career woman. I'm not saying that every woman has to be married and have a family. I'm just saying that there may be some that would be better if they didn't. But I'm also saying that this campaign to depict success and happiness as that alone is one of the most insidious deceptions ever palmed off on behalf of the devil himself. And it's an attempt to destroy the home and the family and marriage. And, you know, we all understand marriage depicts a relationship between Christ and the church. And if there's anything the devil hates, it's a relationship between Christ and the church. Now, in Proverbs 18, verse number 22, this is what the Bible says about marriage. This is what the Bible says about wifehood. It says this very candidly: "Whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtaineth favor of the Lord." That is, he's the right kind of a wife and he's the right kind of a husband. Now, you marry some ding-a-ling and you won't find your favor, I'll guarantee you that. But you ought to be a lot more careful in who you marry, you know. That's where the problem is. There's a lot more to marriage than looking at her and thinking, boy, she's cute. She's really got a good figure. You get married for that kind of a reason, boy, that's awful shallow. That'll wear off in short order. Or she looks at the fellow, oh, he's handsome. I think he's so cute. I think he's just the most handsome specimen I ever laid eyes on. Yeah, maybe he is. But is he going to be a good husband? Is he going to support you? And is he going to be faithful and loyal to you? And is he going to be considerate and kind? You better ask those questions. Those are far more important than whether he's cute or whether he's handsome. Anyway, the book of Hebrews tells us very plainly how God reviews the married state. And in one very brief statement here, notice it in Hebrews the 13th chapter and verse number 4. Marriage is honorable in all. So God looks on marriage as an honorable thing. As far as a wife is concerned, as far as wifehood is concerned, what does the Bible say? Proverbs 5, verse number 18, it tells us, "Let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth." Rejoice with her. Well, I can tell you this, you can rejoice with her if you appreciate her and if you build her up and if you'll encourage her to be a good wife and a proper wife and a good homemaker. Nobody else is for marriage and for the state of matrimony and for the home and the children except God's people. And those people who do understand, you know, there are a lot of people, Christian people, you know, and I'm using that term very loosely and very broadly, who do recognize marriage as an institution of God and is honorable and should be, but I can tell you there's probably many, many more who do not appreciate it and don't recognize that it is truly a spiritual thing too. You cannot have marriage without religion, you know that? Because marriage is a divine institution. So rejoice, the Bible tells us here. And in Ecclesiastes 9, verse number 9, "Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity." Well, you know, that's reciprocal. And if you're encouraging her and showing her how valuable she really is and how much she is to be appreciated, then she's going to do that much more of a better job. She's not going to get it from all the press, I can tell you that. She isn't going to get it from the one-eyed monster. She's not going to get it from the publications. In fact, most of the dribble, the vast majority of the dribble she gets from those sources is going to be, well, you know, you need to be a career lady. Find yourself in a new career. To destroy the marriage state, to destroy motherhood, to destroy what God gave, that's what these people are after. Oh, they're not going to succeed. Bible says that. But they've caused a lot of misery and a lot of havoc in between, and they'll cause a lot more misery and havoc before it's over. But their day is coming. And in going to the New Testament again, 1 Timothy 5, verse number 8, there's another very good statement. You see, we're talking about the responsibility of appreciating your wife, and the more you can do in the home, and the more you can help out financially, the more you can bear that burden, the more that you can be the provider and the head of your household, the more efficiently she can be a wife. That's what it says here. "If any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel." Now maybe you can't help it. You know, we are living in a world where we don't really have that much control. You look at the newspapers, you know, the headlines say, "Euphoria sets in because the Federal Reserve has now reduced its prime rate to 14.5%. Other interest rates have now dropped to 10%. You can't look at that and realize that the American public is the most gullible, manipulated people on the face of the earth, and you're not controlling anything, and the politicians aren't controlling anything. It's a handful of moneyed lords who have made themselves gods who are controlling things. Then you can see why people can't go out and make a living, and why a husband can't be the head of his house the way God intended. These people don't want it that way. All right, you just have to do the best you can under the circumstances. If your wife's forced to work, then you better be willing to help out in the home and bear that burden until such a time as you can be the rightful head of the household and make the living wholeheartedly. Maybe that time will never come in this life. I do not know. My guess would be that it's going to be increasingly difficult. If I understand anything about the book of Revelation and what Babylon the Great is pulling off, it will indeed be increasingly difficult. So you may have to bear the burden, help bear the burden in the home. And then finally, in closing here, you know, wifehood is an honorable thing in the sight of God, and a wife needs to receive the credit that's due her for that, and she needs to be built up and encouraged. That's why it's talking about this virtuous woman here in Proverbs, the 31st chapter. You think there's anything unbecoming of motherhood and wifehood and being a woman in the home, then go back and read over this chapter again, because this virtuous woman, it actually means from the Hebrew, is a strong, you know, a formidable woman, a woman who's aggressive in her own right, one who's a competent person, a one who has good sense, you know, a woman who uses her mind and her abilities. And you know what it says here? It says here in verse number 28, her children arise up and call her blessed. How many times do you children stand up when your mother comes in, you arise and call her blessed? You appreciate what she does for you. Well, I can tell you, you know, just like all kids are the same. You know when I really appreciated my parents? I'll tell you when I appreciated my parents. When I became a parent. It's the first time I really appreciated my parents. Till that time, I guess there isn't anything more unappreciative than youth, it seems to be. Her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. You praise your wives? We got a kind of a standing joke in my house. Maybe I shouldn't even say it because it was kind of a takeoff from what old Milt Scott used to flatter Mr. Armstrong all the time. But my wife cooks a good meal and I tell her in front of the kids, you did it again. And boy, I'll tell you one thing my wife will say about me. If I tell her that, I mean it. Because if she doesn't fix a good meal, I usually don't say anything. But that's very, 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 very rare. In fact, almost never. Well, it says here, verse number 31, give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. So let's just recognize, men, we have a responsibility to build up our wives, to support the weaker vessel in the face of this insidious attack, which is attempting to down womanhood and motherhood. And let's realize we have a responsibility to encourage and to support the weaker vessel. We have to have a proper understanding of what it means to be a husband and a head of a household without a faulty administrative approach, and we have to be heirs together spiritually and physically. And if we work on those things, I think we can truly say we can be better Christian husbands.